Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
Welcome to the Scott Radley Show for this very moist Thursday evening. And I know, moist is one of those words that nobody likes. You're not supposed to say moist because it's just a word that makes everybody uncomfortable. But all right, so we'll go with a very highly humid Thursday. It is all of that out there. Hope everyone is dry and safe wherever they are on the roads or whatever. Glad you're with us on a day that honestly, I don't want to overdo this because we're going to talk about it later, but with a little more on the legal side of things and impact that it had. But I got to tell you, I was shocked today when I saw this tweet that O.J. Simpson had died. You may have been as well. First of all, I find it hard to believe that he's 76 years old because it just seems that he is forever, 45 or whatever he was at the time of the trial. That's sort of when he's locked into our minds. You don't really think of him as older than that. But what a it's one of those stories that if you were alive at that time, it really had no impact on us, real impact. But you cannot not remember and not have a million different thoughts on this one. And I'll tell you who, there's a bunch. One person that I really wish had been alive today, I really wish Norm MacDonald had been alive today. Remember Norm MacDonald? He was on Saturday Night Live and he was the Weekend Update guy who, the story goes, got fired because he wouldn't relent on his just shredding of O.J. Simpson in the Weekend Update because somebody involved at NBC was still buddies with O.J. and wanted him to stop and he wouldn't. I really wish Norm MacDonald was alive today because you know there would be some absolute gems about this. And I don't, I don't have any worries about, I'm not worried about O.J. Simpson being offended. I'm not because, he's a human being. And so I don't know that it's good for us to wish ill on any human being. In fact, I'm quite sure it's not, regardless of what they've done. But at the same time, I have very little doubt about what he did, and I never heard any kind of, not that he has to ask my forgiveness or confess to me, but I never heard any kind of sign that he was sorry or that there was sorrow or grief or any, regardless. So for Norm MacDonald or anyone else to have comments at his expense. This is such a complicated story, isn't it? In a certain ways, because again, I don't think that it's healthy for us to wish ill upon anyone. But at the same time, I don't doubt what he did. I don't care what the court said. I don't care what that jury said. That jury was primarily made up of people who clearly were not paying attention. There's not much doubt about what O.J. Simpson did, and it's hard to, I know some people can't get their head still, all these years later, can't wrap their head, can't separate the star football player and the comedic actor from a guy who did what we learned in court that they said he didn't do, but we all know that he did. And it was horrendous. It does say something, I think, about how difficult it is for people to see past the veneer. I mean, O.J. Simpson, there's no question, O.J. Simpson, his public persona, he was a charming guy. The Hertz commercials and his interviews and his work on NBC Sports when he was covering football and all that, he was a charming guy. There's no question. And yet you cannot look at what he did and not say, that's not who he was. We shouldn't be feeling sorry or whatever. I mean, it's just, anyway, it's an interesting day. You know who else I feel badly for? And this is totally stupid. And I thought about this today. It's just a totally stupid thing, but the Buffalo Bills, who he played for, are among the most cursed franchises in all of sports. They really are. Four straight Super Bowl losses. They should have won a couple of those. In recent years, things have happened that have gone against them. And after all of that, the greatest player ever to wear their uniform, they can't even celebrate because of who O.J. Simpson was and what he became and everything else. Every other team, their greatest player dies. This is a moment for the franchise to remember the good old days and everything else. And I know that on the grand scheme of things, Buffalo Bills fans celebrating a great player is well down the list. But nonetheless, I did think about this today, that any other franchise's greatest ever player dies, it is a moment to remember great times from the past. They can't do that. This is so Buffalo Bills. Although, again, that's a well down the list of things today. But yes, it did pop into mind. Anyway, we're going to be talking a little later next hour. Not more. We're not going to just rehash the whole O.J. Simpson thing, but there is a really interesting part of this story that, you know, even in retrospect, I think has application for us. The O.J. Simpson trial, which I'm sure you watched some of, if you're of that age or old enough to remember, was the real crystallizing point about should we have cameras in courtrooms or not. Canadians, by and large, with very few exceptions, if any, have said, courts have said here, we're not going to have cameras in our courtrooms. American courtrooms, many of them have them. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? When the Paul Bernardo trial, for example, and that's the closest I can think of to OJ as far as a Canadian case, as far as publicity and outrage and everything else. When the Paul Bernardo trial was going on, ironically, not that long afterwards, about 4 years after OJ, what would have been different? Would anything have been different? Would justice have been seen to be served more or less if that courtroom had had cameras and people could have sat at home and watched that the same way we watched the OJ Simpson trial? Would Canadian justice be better today if we had cameras in the courtrooms? Or are we thankful that we don't as a result of what we saw in that trial? We're going to get to that next hour, so I'm going to get into that one because I think it's a really interesting point. And again, that's the probably most clear example of what can happen for better or for worse when you do that. We're going to be chatting about HSR and LRT and who should run it because this is back in the news again. Who should be doing that? Assuming the LRT gets built, who should be operating this one? We'll get to that in just a couple of moments. We're also going to be talking about the rotten egg smell. Have you smelled rotten eggs in downtown Hamilton? People are saying they're smelling rotten eggs. And now we're trying to search and find out what is the cause of the rotten eggs. We will talk about the search for the stink coming up. And the end of next hour, Saturday is Forge FC's season opener, 4-time out of 5 years, champion of the Canadian Premier League. We will talk to Tristan Borges of Forge FC as they get going. As always, the first segment of the Scott Radley Show is brought to you exclusively by Fox40Shop.com. For sport and for safety, it has to be Fox40Shop.com. Enter the promo code Radley at checkout, and you will get 25% off your order. We're going to take a very quick break, and when we come back, who should operate our LRT if and when it ever gets up and running? We'll do that next. Stay with us.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
All right, well, let's start talking about everybody's favorite topic in Hamilton, shall we? I say that somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but it is the topic that we've said this a million times on the show. It is the topic that we will probably still be talking about when all of us are dead and buried. They will still be discussing this. It is the LRT. The LRT that we are told is getting closer, I say, with question-raising voice at the end of a sentence, because, you know, this is the project in this city that would be unquestionably the largest construction project in forever. But it just seems that we can't get any kind of real sense of when and if this is going to start. We talked last week about the fact that the Spectator, Matthew Van Dongen of the Spectator, through, I think, Freedom of Information, found this report that now projects like this have gone up in price by as much or more than 30%, which suggests that it's not going to be $3.4 billion anymore. It's going to be, well, what's 30% more on top of that? I mean, this is just such a difficult thing to try and keep up with because there are so many moving parts, and it's not a comment on the tracks. It is literally, there are so many moving parts to this story. it's really hard to know what's happening with it at this point. However, let us, for the sake of argument, assume this gets built. Probably will, we think. But let's assume, for the sake of this argument, that the LRT does get built, does become a thing, trains are on the tracks. Who is going to operate them? Well, this is a bone of contention, too, because there are suggestions that it should be someone who is sub-traded out, that someone is allowed to make a bid and operate it. Others are saying, no, this should only be the HSR. It's part of the Hamilton transit system, even though it's being built by the province and by Metrolinx, but it's part of Hamilton's transit system. Therefore, it only makes sense that our transit workers are the ones to do this. Well, there is a Main Street poll. Main Street's the name of the company, Main Street's the company. There's a Main Street poll that was done in February, at near the end of February, over 5 days, that was taken across the city so that it's not just in one or two wards, asking Hamiltonians, who do you think should operate LRT, assuming it gets built? And the overwhelming percentage, 2 out of 3, say that they want HSR employees to operate this. Only 7.7% say that they would like a private contractor to be hired. There was also a portion of it that was unknown. We didn't really have an opinion. But 2/3 of Hamiltonians say they want HSR employees to run the LRT. I don't know if you're surprised by that. I don't think I'm surprised by that number when I hear it. I think people, by and large, in this city, probably as is the case in most cities, probably like the idea of local people doing local jobs. I don't really think that we should be shocked by this at all. And maybe, I don't know if this is part of the reason, what was the last big project that we had in the city that was not done, not bid upon, not done by necessarily local workers? The stadium. And how many problems did we have with the stadium? Many is the answer. So I don't know if people's memory is long or if they just are supportive of Hamilton people doing Hamilton jobs, whatever the reason. 2/3 or more want HSR workers to do this. Okay, that's fine. Here's what we don't know, though, still, and I'm still shocked that we don't know this. We still have absolutely no idea what this thing is going to cost to operate. Forget the fact that we don't know what it's going to cost to build this thing. We have no idea what it's going to cost to build it. We literally have no idea. The only thing I can say with that I feel with absolute certainty that I would, as a non-gambling man, that I would be willing to put money on. The only thing I can say for certain is I don't believe that it's going to cost what we were told back 4 years ago or 5 years ago that it was going to cost, or 3 years ago, whatever it was. It's gone up. It's not $3.4 billion anymore. It's going to cost more. But how much is it going to cost to operate this thing? And I think that's a key part of this. Regardless of whether HSR or anyone else operates this, last time, the last update, the last estimate that we had to operate this was that it'll cost between $6 million and $16.5 million. I believe those were the correct numbers. $6 million and $16.5 million to run this thing every year. Remember something, though. Toronto is launching 2 LRT lines. The one of them up in Finch is double the length of what ours is going to be. So you would presume that the costs are going to be double. That would make sense. They're estimating that theirs is going to cost something like $105 million a year to operate. Cut that in half, you're looking at about $50 million to operate theirs. Why is ours potentially going to be 6? Makes our estimate, in my mind, entirely implausible, entirely unreliable. And so this is not right now, we can argue all day long about whether the LRT is going to be good or bad or something else altogether. That argument has been going on. No one's going to change their mind at this point, I don't think. But I think that we are, in this city, entitled as taxpayers and as voters, I think we're getting to the point, we've been there for a long time now, entitled to have some idea of what impact this is going to have. Even if you are absolutely, unequivocally on board with the concept of LRT and you believe wholeheartedly that this thing is great for the city, fine. I'm not arguing with you about the LRT. I go back and forth. Honestly, I've been pretty much agnostic about it. I think it's going to be not as destructive as some people have pointed to it. I also don't believe it's going to solve every problem the city has, like some people have made it into this panacea. But we are entitled to know what this is going to cost us. We can't seem to get numbers. That to me is, I think we should be entitled to know before we take the last step towards building this thing. I think we should be entitled to know what it's going to cost. And what if it is going to cost us $50 million? What if we have the same cost as Toronto does? What if it's $50 million a year to run? Does that change our mind at all on who operates it or whether we should do it or anything like that? That would be an extra roughly 5% on your taxes right off the bat just for the LRT. Does that change anything? Interestingly, this Main Street survey was asking a number of other questions. And according to a story that I was reading, they asked about people's support for LRT. They didn't include those numbers in the poll, as it turns out, in the survey. That didn't seem to be included. But ATU President Eric Tuck told the Bay Observer that support for the project, quote, has eroded. I think if it's eroded, because everyone I think was locked into their position, if it's eroded, I think it's because there's so much secrecy. Nobody has a clue at this point what this thing is going to cost. We need to start getting some numbers. We need to start getting some transparency. We need to start getting some idea of what this is going to mean. And if we're hiding stuff or if we're not willing to say stuff, to me, that only means it's bad news. We need to know what this is going to cost. And you want to know something? If it's not Toronto levels of money, if we can do this for better, if this is not going to look like that, I think it's going to reinforce some people's view that the LRT would be a good thing if they could be reassured that this thing is going to be not the cost that some places are going to be. The longer we go without knowing, if there is erosion, the more erosion I think there's going to be. We need to start knowing this stuff, whether it's HSR running it or anyone else. Let me know. What do you think about that? I mean, the poll was done about HSR or not. I think that sounds like it's pretty much settled, but do you feel confident that you know what this thing is going to cost in any way, any more than anyone else? Text line is 905-645-3221. You can let me know. I'd love to hear from you. We will take a break. When we come back after the break, we're going to get into that apparent stinky, rotten egg smell in the downtown, in the lower city. Is it a thing? Have you smelled it down there? And if so, what is it? We're going to find out after this.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Scott Radley Show here on 900 CHML. I'm reasonably sure that the Hamilton Tourist Board is not going to use this as their motto, but does our city stink? does Hamilton stink? I don't know that that's the way to boost enthusiasm for the city. I love this city. I've never had a problem personally with noticing the city stinks. Now, that just could be my olfactory device. My nose may not be, you know, you get older, you don't, it's not as sharp. I may just not be picking up on some of the bouquets of this town as much as others are. But apparently there are people who say that, especially the lower city, that there are some pervasive and ongoing fragrances, rotten egg fragrances to be specific, that now scientists, experts are looking into studying to find out if they can determine the origin of said stinks. Matthew Adams is an assistant professor and GIS program director of geography, geomatics, and environment with the University of Toronto, who joins us now. Matthew, how are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you, Scott?
I am well. So am I the only one then, Matthew, who doesn't go downtown and and pick up this odor of rotten eggs? Am I missing something that everyone else is catching?
I think it's a smallish area, mostly in kind of wards 3 and 4, where we've been hearing complaints about this issue. So I just finished up a project monitoring kind of our traditional air pollutants across Hamilton, industry, traffic. And as part of that narrative with speaking with the public, I kept hearing about these sulfur egg smell complaints.
All right, because we do live in an industrial city, and there are smells at times, but the rotten egg smell, I just haven't caught. Now, probably some people are listening going, well, you haven't been in the right places, as you pointed out, but this, where would this come from? I mean, is this the kind of chemical, and I assume we can call it a chemical, is this the kind of compound that a steel mill or somewhere else would naturally be emitting? Does this make sense?
Part of the coke production, turning coal into coke, will emit hydrogen sulfide, giving that stink. Speaking with some of the people who work directly there, it is very pungent. Now, there's other sources too, kind of that if you have a sewer gas back up into your house, that can cause that same smell. Even out by, Sulfur Mineral Springs, Sulfur Springs Road, we have natural sources of this smell. But we're really interested in kind of this Ward 3, Ward 4 concerns that we've been hearing.
Okay, if it was stinky, I get that is really a deterrent, not a deterrent. It's not going to be good for your quality of life if every time you step outside you smell rotten eggs. Is it harmful?
It just depends at what the concentrations are. At very, very high concentrations, but typically ones you might be exposed into an industrial setting, yes, it can be very harmful. At concentrations we expect, it's more of a nuisance. It can irritate your eyes. It can irritate your throat. But we have no idea what concentrations are even expected. We do hear a lot of complaints. We hear some people being concerned about eyes and ears being kind of scratchy or itchy during the same time. So we'll have to see what's out there.
So how do you measure smell other than by having people say it smells really bad or it smells only moderate? Is there a scientific way to gauge levels of stink?
Yeah, it's definitely actually a really tricky science. So this one compound we're measuring that does give that sulfur smell, we can capture it with a little coated filter, and then we can analyze that in the lab, and kind of the molecules that make the stink accumulate on our filters, and that's what we measure. But sometimes smells can be a whole sort of different sets of compounds, and you and me might smell them differently than someone else as well. So it's challenging, but the sulfur smell, we can capture that one with our systems.
That was the next thing I was going to ask you, is that certain people, and this may be a weird question, but certain people have more capacity to something that's sour tastes even more sour to them, or something that's sweet will taste more sweet. Do different people have different smellers, so that this smell may be the same smell might be way worse for someone else as someone else?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just like taste. We all have tastes that we enjoy. Sometimes they're more pungent than others. But yeah, smell, some people might, especially if you maybe you've been working in a setting where you were exposed to maybe some more chemicals than others, you might have lost some of your smell. So there's definitely going to be a difference. Some people will be more susceptible than others.
But even if you're, okay, so I know that people especially either by being around it or with age, you lose some of the smell acuity. But even if you were not taking that into consideration, do different people have naturally different levels of ability to smell?
I don't know how much science there is on that, but okay. Yeah, there's definitely anecdotal evidence that people smell differently. Well, everything you think, some perfumes you might enjoy,
sure.
Some perfumes someone else might not enjoy. I think that's a good distinction as well.
Okay, so let's go back to this idea of this filter. How does this work? You place it outside a home or in a home, or how does it work that you are going to capture smell in a sort of data way?
Yeah, so we're actually measuring both outside the home and inside the home. Our goal is twofold. We want to understand what these levels are, both inside and outside, to give us a sense, is it coming from the outdoors in? Are there other sources? We're also going to be measuring in some areas where this could be generated in the home, for example, the basement versus the kitchen, just to make sure what we're capturing is actually coming from the outside.
Someone's not boiling eggs all day and making, you know, natural sulfur.
Exactly. We're trying to stay away from people composting in their kitchen, for example.
Yeah. Well, if they're composting in their kitchen, maybe they got bigger problems. I mean, I don't know if anyone does that, but yeah, they probably shouldn't complain about smells if that's happening. But no, I find this fascinating that it's possible to measure smell in a scientific way, because it's just nothing that I've ever thought of before that you could capture that. Although I suppose everything is particles, right?
Yeah, it's gases, and each compound, you know, smells can often be associated to a specific chemical fingerprint. We'll think of it that way. And we just measure those fingerprints in the air.
So when you do this and when you start to examine the data, what will become of that? Presumably, you would be able to find areas where the smell is the idea to find out where it's coming from, and then to be able to get industry, if that's where it's coming from, to do something about it? Or what would be the ultimate end to this?
Yeah, that would, you know, if we do identify elevated high concentrations, that would be the goal. And once we start mapping it out, we can see the patterns, and we can associate that to, you know, wind direction and other factors that are going to impact where that could be coming from. And then Hamilton has had a great history of working with its industry to reduce air pollution over time. You know, we've seen huge improvements over the last few decades with great partnerships between the municipality and the industry. So if we do identify an issue, I'm pretty confident we can hopefully work together to reduce those effects.
It's a fascinating thing that you're doing. And I know there are a lot of people downtown, as I say, even though I haven't necessarily picked it up, I can't imagine if my house was in an area where this was a thing, dealing with this all the time. So I'm sure there are many, many, many people who are thrilled that someone is looking into this and trying to find an answer to this. The man's name who's doing that is Matthew Adams, Assistant Professor and GIS Program Director of Geography, Geomatics, and Environment with University of Toronto. Matthew, thanks for doing this today.
Thank you for having me.
Fascinating topic, fascinating thing to look into. I'm glad, as I say, I'm glad someone is. That's a good thing. We will take a break here. When we come back, the rotating story of the day today, Matt's story of the day. When we come back, stay with us.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
It is 6:50 on a Thursday evening. It is time for Matt's story of the day. Matt is in doing all the technical work today, doing all the real work here on the show. Here's how this works. I'm going to give Matt three stories from around the world, unique stories, unusual stories, sometimes implausible or unbelievable stories, but they're all true. Matt will then consider them all and decide which one he likes best. That's Matt's story of the day. Matt, are you ready for this today?
I am ready.
Let us start in England, where a political party fired one of its candidates because of inactivity. They said, we're moving towards an election here. We're not seeing much from you. We need our candidates in our different ridings to be active and getting stuff going and making hay and like really stirring things up. They then later had to apologize when they learned that candidate had been dead for 2 months. You know, unsurprisingly, the deceased candidate was not all that active in the election, amazingly enough. Happens, I guess, right? Story number two, this one also comes from England, where this is in Bicester. I'm not sure how, if that's it, B-I-C-E-S-T-R, Bicester, Bicester, I'm sure it's, anyway. The police station there, the police officers were confused and concerned because it seemed that one of their cruisers, the siren kept going off. Or somewhere on the property of the police station, they kept hearing sirens going and couldn't figure out because none of the cars seemed to have the sirens active, whatever. Turns out that a bird that lived in a tree near the station had learned how to mimic the siren so convincingly that the police were tricked by this and thought one of their cars was on the fritz. That is a talented bird. That is a very talented bird. I don't, it doesn't say what kind of bird it is or was. And when I say was, you know, there's no suggestion the police excised the bird from the tree. It could still be there. I think that a bird as a siren is a great tool. I would try and capture that bird and have it in my house so that if a burglar ever came, I mean, almost as good as a bird that could be trained to sound like a pit bull, although I don't know that such a thing. If I could get a tiny little toy poodle to have the bark of a pit bull, that would be the ideal thing. Anyway, story number three today comes from very close to us in Guelph, Ontario. One-time home of the Hamilton Ticats for one summer. In Guelph, Ontario, a woman, surprisingly, and I don't know why I'm surprised by this, I just am. Maybe it's just, you know, it's not what we expect. But a woman in Guelph has been arrested for a break-in on the weekend. It's not that women don't break into houses at times. I guess they do. It's just what she did in the house. I guess while she was working her way through the house that she'd broken into and trying to gather up whatever belongings it was that she was going to steal, nature's call arrived, and this woman stopped for a while to download a file, shall we say, into the owner's toilet. A large file. The police report simply describes it as a large bowel movement that was left behind by the burglar. And see, here's the thing. They prescription medication, clothing, sunglasses, jewelry, coins, other property was taken. Would they have immediately noticed if they had not come home and not found a giant deuce waiting for them in the toilet? Or was this the sign that, wait a second, someone did something. Someone was here. If I'm a burglar and I have not done that, but I'm thinking that the thing I want to do is leave as little evidence of my being there as possible. This is not that. This is not that. This is an unnecessary reminder or notification that someone had been in the house and doing something. Now, I don't know whether, I don't want to get into all kinds of details here. Some people are still eating dinner. I don't know whether she tried to get rid of it and couldn't. That could happen. Many people listening have probably had that happen at one time in their life. And among the things that she went to steal, she couldn't find a plunger. I don't know if that's the case, but, you know, it just seems unnecessary. Burglars, I would think, want to get in, get out, not be noticed, not leave a giant calling card to announce their presentation there. But anyway, there you go.
So they did catch her, though.
They did catch her. 22-year-old has been charged with break and enter and possessing stolen property, not mischief or damage or some other additional thing for vandalism or something else. I guess she's lucky. But the other thing is, couldn't you, if this had been a really even more serious crime, couldn't they extract DNA? You're leaving evidence. Anyway.
I didn't want to say that, but thank you.
Yeah, but you're leaving evidence behind of your own stuff. Anyway, will your story of the day today be the politician in England who was criticized and fired for being inactive on the campaign trail, only for the party to eventually discover he was doing that because he was dead? Will it be the bird in England that learned how to mimic a police cruiser and cause the police department to believe that one of their sirens was on the fritz? Or will it be the unconstipated burglar in Guelph that decided to take a break from the break-in to leave a special surprise for the homeowners?
See, I'm tempted to go with the last one, but I think it's got to be the first one because of the time frame of the death. 2 months.
2 months they waited to find out that this person was deceased.
That's beyond the acceptable amount of time.
On the flip side, should someone in this person's family not have alerted the party that maybe you want to find a different candidate because dad is dead?
Yeah, and again, there's that grace period, you know, everything's very complicated. Everything's, you know, a little bit stressful. 2 months, yeah, there's a lot of fingers to be pointed.
Yeah,
here.
I would like to think that if in my riding, for example, in the upcoming election a year and a half from now, if one of the candidates of any of the parties was to cease existing partway through the campaign, that we would learn about this, that we would not just go to the polls without any idea that they were dead. But anyway, all right, there's Matt's story of the day. We will take a break for the news. When we come back after the break, we are going to be talking about our criminal justice system and TV in courtrooms. It's in relation to what we learned today that O.J. Simpson died, the example of TV in the courtroom and its benefits or curses. Get into that. And Forge FC's season kicks off on Saturday. We'll be talking to Tristan Borges of the team. Do all of that. Plus your quiz question coming up next. Stay with us.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Hour number two of the Scott Radley Show here on 900 CHML. Thanks for being with us. Glad you could be here. Hope you're dry wherever you are. Hope nobody's got a basement problem today. Today's one of those days that I've been there. I have, my wife and I, we have had the basement problem once upon a time with the water. There are few things more devastating, that's not the right word, more crushing than coming home to find a indoor pool in your basement that you hadn't planned on. So nobody's dealing with that today because that stinks. That is a mess. Anyway, hopefully not. Here, we got a lot of things to get to this hour, so let me give you your quiz question, and then we're going to get going. And today's quiz question ties into the news of the day today. The news of the day, of course, that we learned about 3 o'clock or thereabouts that O.J. Simpson had died today. And, of course, that got everybody, at least anyone who was old enough to remember, that got everyone thinking about that time and that trial and everything else. So if you were old enough to remember, you probably may get this one. But this is the one name from the trial that I could not remember, and I thought, all right, let's see if everyone else has the same trouble. What was the name of the judge in the O.J. Simpson trial? The criminal trial, not the civil one. What was the name of the judge in the O.J. Simpson trial? 905-645-3221, *9900, or text us at 905-645-3221. The name of the judge who oversaw that trial, what was it? As soon as you hear it, you're going to go, oh, yeah, of course. Of course. How could I forget if you forget? I forgot. 905-645-3221, *9900 if you're calling and the lines are busy, call right back. If you're calling and Matt doesn't get to you fast enough, call back because he will. He's got to answer a bunch of lines here. So be persistent and you will get through. We'd love to hear from you. Speaking of the O.J. Simpson trial, and I don't want to go back into all the details of the Bronco chase and all that. You know all that. You've heard about that today. All that stuff. But there was one part of the story that, you know, in retrospect, has an impact on us, I think. And that was the reality that this trial was televised and it became a soap opera. There's no question about it. It became the daily activity for an awful lot of people. They would tape it or they would be at home and they would watch it. And it was entertainment, really. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. It was entertainment. And this is what people talked about at work and at the coffee shop and at the bar. And you had your favorites and you had your unfavorites and you hated Mark Furman and you liked Johnny Cochran and you weren't sure about Chris Darden and all these people. But that the fact that that was on television, it exposed a lot of people to the law, for better or for worse. Some people say it made a mockery of the law. Others say, no, it put sunlight on the legal system and on the case, and therefore we could have a better idea about what was going on. But that's something that, by and large, has never caught on in this country. Have we missed out? Are we missing out by not having our biggest trials in this country televised? Let me bring in Jeff Manishin. He is a criminal lawyer here in town. He's a former Crown attorney. He's a guy who's been in many big-time trials over the years, some which could have been televised, presumably, if this was available here. Jeff, how are you tonight?
Oh, good, Scott. How about you?
I am fine, thank you. I'm, this is what I got thinking about today. It's sort of a weird thing, but What about that idea? I mean, first of all, before we get into whether it would be helpful or a bad thing, what is our law in this country around televising trials? Is it up to a judge and they just never do it, or is it against the law?
Wow. I'm hearing some extra interference, Scott. I don't know about you. Someone else is commenting at the same time as us.
Yeah, no, I am also hearing that in the background. Matt is working on that right now. So, tell you what, there we go. Okay,
I think we got it. Good work,
okay.
Matt.
All right, so...
could you repeat the question?
So, is it legal right now in Canada? Could a trial judge in this country say, yes, I'm going to allow a trial to be televised, or is it not allowed in Canada or in Ontario?
If I'm not mistaken, I know with respect to Ontario anyway, the Courts of Justice Act doesn't permit it. In fact, we don't even allow the filming of activity inside the courthouse itself. In other words, people walking in and out of the hall. So we would never have the equivalent of Donald Trump coming out of court and doing a press conference within the walls of the courthouse. It would have to be outside.
Okay.
We don't permit that. Where we have allowed it is in certain cases. Certainly the Supreme Court of Canada arguments are available on the parliamentary channel, so you can see those. In addition, you'll recall the Ben Johnson Royal Commissioner, Public Inquiry.
The Dublin Inquiry.
The Dublin Inquiry, we got to see that. And I was involved in the Gouge Inquiry, and that was available. It was streamed. People could see it online. So we have allowed public inquiries to be heard. I think there have been other forms of proceedings where that's taken place. If I'm not mistaken, I think there was a trial in Oshawa with a couple of off-duty police officers who, if I'm not mistaken, were charged with assaulting a guy, and the sentencing was streamed. It was available. The judge decided to let the public see that. But it's really exceptional.
Do you think, and I mean, look, the O.J. Simpson trial was certainly an exception because it was such a circus. It was such a thing. But I do wonder if it would have been as much of a circus if there wasn't TV. But generally, do you look at that and say, you know what, it's good for justice to be seen by the broadest possible audience because it puts sunlight on it? Or do you say, no, this kind of thing does tend to really screw up justice because people want to put on a show then?
The former. I'm in favor of TV in the courtroom. I think one of the challenges has to do with the interest of at least some of the parties. I can imagine victims of crimes might say, look, I don't want to be in the public eye that way, or witnesses in important cases. I don't want that. But I think that if you had the consent of the parties, I think there's room for that. I think there are proceedings. Imagine, for example, Scott, let's say a plea and sentencing in something significant where it's not a matter of witnesses testifying. I could imagine that the public would certainly want to see that. I don't believe that the parties are going to play for the cameras in the slightest. And I think that for people to be able to see the way that the administration of justice does get administered would go a long ways towards public having confidence in our system.
Well, and theoretically, it could also work the other way. It could make people lack confidence in the system if things didn't go the way they thought. But it would certainly, as I say, it would put sunlight on it one way or another.
Well, on the outcome, I think the difficulty with that one, Scott, if you say people would lack confidence, their lack of confidence in theory could be because they don't like the outcome.
Yes,
but
yes.
But what the heck, they might as well see the process. How often have you heard it that people say, oh, the judge didn't sentence the guy to a long enough term, but they haven't heard the submissions of the parties, and they haven't heard the full details of the judge giving reasons. I think that's where, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was Justice Joe DeLuca did it in Oshawa in that case. I think that a judge would, in certain respects, would benefit from the opportunity of the public getting to hear and see how he or she administers justice. I mean, I've been in front of lots of judges, and I can't help but be impressed for the most part with the way in which they do their jobs. And the public don't get to see that because they can't get over to the courthouse.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe you have a better example. I was trying to think of a Canadian equivalent as far as publicity and interest as the O.J. Simpson trial. The only one that immediately came to mind was Bernardo.
Yeah,
so let's use that one as the example. Someone could come up with a different one. That's fine. But how do you think things would have been different, if at all, in people's perception and their thoughts on the system and everything else, if the Bernardo trial had been televised. Now, there were parts of it, obviously, that couldn't because they were showing tapes that were horrendous and everything else. But if, by and large, generally, if the trial had generally been public and televised, how would that have changed anything?
I don't know that it would have that much because it was so sensational. There was so much intense public interest. People were literally lining up to get into the courtroom. Would televising at least parts of the proceeding significantly enhanced public attention? Sure. I mean, imagine when Carla Homolka is testifying.
Yes.
And is being cross-examined. I think that the viewership would be very substantial. But if we say for a moment, and what would be the downside of that? What would be the bad part of that? Because we'd have people having a heightened level of attention to what the allegations were. Now, one might say, but the French Mahaffey families might say, we don't want it televised. We don't want her getting that kind of attention. It might effectively almost glorify her. Yeah, or alternatively, it might show the public that this is this individual, and seeing her cross-examined on the public would get a chance to say, look, our courts are supposed to be open to the public. Right, that we have that's an integral part of our system of justice, and people can't get there to be there in person, but they want a chance to be able to see it. That's part of our democratic process. Let's try a different one. I mean, the trial that happened in London with the guy that was convicted of first-degree murder in the murder of that Muslim family. I could envision that trial having a substantial amount of public attention from the standpoint of how people would get some sense of the venality of the guy's behavior and get a sense of how our system of justice dealt with all of that. I bet that case would certainly get public attention. Would it be into the realm of being sensationalist? I would like to think not.
I am sitting here completely drawing a blank on the name of the lawyer who represented Carla Homolka in that trial.
Oh, I know him. He's a good buddy of mine. But remember that he didn't represent Carla Homolka in the trial because she pled. George Walker represented her. He used to practice in Niagara Falls. He retired some time ago. John Rosen represented
John Rosen. John Rosen. And so, and I wonder, because I was not at that trial. I was not covering that trial. Many people from The Spectator were. They had a huge contingent.
My wife was one of the court reporters.
Okay. And so everything I read was that John Rosen handled himself as a distinguished lawyer and didn't put on a show, didn't have theatrics. He was doing what lawyers are supposed to do. So I don't know if he's the perfect example of this, but had there been TV cameras in there, do you think lawyers, and I sort of suggest this at the beginning, do you think lawyers behave differently if they suddenly learn, you know what, I put on a bit of a show, I'm going to build clients for down the road, I'm going to become famous, I'm going to whatever. Does it change the way the law is done?
No, I've known John Rosen for many, many years. It wouldn't change him in the slightest. John would do the job exactly the same way, and the reason is John's focus is to do what he can for his client. And that's his focus. Whether the public is watching or not, a packed courtroom, an empty courtroom, TV, no TV, he'd do his job the same way. And, you know, I've done cases myself, Scott, over the course of years, where, in theory, the public, if they had been televised, would it have been extra scrutiny? Sure, but I have to focus on the job and do the job the way I have to because, shall we say, my most important audience is the jury or is the judge in a judge alone case. That others are watching, I'm not playing for them. I'm not doing what I'm doing for them. I'm doing what I'm doing to represent my client the best way I know how, and John would have been exactly the same. I have total confidence in that.
What about this? Our systems, the American justice system and our justice system are different. Is there anything in the differences that would make their system more amenable to TV or ours less or other way around? Is there any difference that would say it wouldn't work here?
That's a really good question, and I don't know that there is. I mean, we know that, for example, seeing some of the proceedings in Donald Trump's trials at the state court versus at the federal court. I mean, imagine watching some of the proceedings in the Georgia case and seeing the cross-examination of witnesses. I mean, that Fani Willis testifies and is cross-examined. And you might say, gee, you know, what would our system be like if we had a situation such as that? I don't believe that it's changed in any way. And you get a chance, instead of hearing about it and hearing others interpret it, no disrespect to reporters and columnists and bloggers and those who are sitting in court, they're filtering it. They're giving us their take on it. There's no substitute for us getting to see it for ourselves and knowing. And I mean, some of the Trump, the federal trial, the one that with respect to the insurrection that Jack Smith is prosecuting, one that's currently going to be argued before the U.S. Supreme Court on the issue of immunity. That, if there was ever a trial that the American people and frankly everyone should get a chance to see, it would be that one, and we aren't going to.
You were you've been a Crown attorney as well as a defense lawyer. Do you think that Crown attorneys would like that? I have no doubt, regardless of, you know, whether they would put on a show or not, I have no doubt that there are a lot of defense attorneys, defense lawyers, who would be liking this because, again, whether they would put on a show or not, it would build up business. If they did well and their case was on TV and people watched it, they were effective. When someone got in trouble, they'd probably say, you know what, that Jeff Manishin guy did a great job. He was fantastic. I watched him. That's good for business. What about Crown attorneys? Would they want this? Would they want that fame or not fame, especially if things went wrong? If someone got off on a case that they should have won or thought they should have won or people thought they should have won, would the Crown's office want to go down this route?
That's a great question. And I don't know that it would be a matter of want or not want. I think there might be defense counsel that prefer not getting on TV, and I think there may be Crowns who might prefer that too. On the other hand, would it affect the way they do their job? They would do their job the same way. And I have to tell you too, Scott, by the way, I mean, as you know, I've done a fair bit of legal commentary, TV, radio. I've had trials that have worked out really well. I have never really felt there was a big appreciable impact on business if I happen to win a trial or if I'm on TV or if I'm on radio. It doesn't seem to work that way. People have a variety of ways in which they pick lawyers. And I don't know that it's as simple as, gee, he looked good or she looked good on TV, I want to hire them. Yeah, you're right. Crowns might feel that extra measure of stress with respect to public scrutiny in which they, the way in which they do their job. But believe me, they feel plenty of it now.
You don't,
I mean, if there happens to be a case that doesn't work out, the Crowns can be criticized in the public eye. And the Crowns have to count on the Ministry of Attorney General to proverbially have their backs, you know, and basically be there for them. And sometimes it happens, but other times it doesn't. So it's a stressful job being a Crown without TV. Yeah, there'll be an extra level of scrutiny, but I believe that Crowns would say, look, when we do things the way they do, the way we do, if an outcome doesn't go the way we're looking for it, the public will be able to say, well, gee, that Crown did a terrific jury address or did a great cross-examination.
I'm interested, though, that your idea that, you know, you've done a lot of this stuff and yet it hasn't really impacted fame or business or anything else, because I mean I drive around town and I see billboards for law firms and saying come and do business with us. Surely having eyeballs on you or other lawyers has to draw attention, and if you could get involved in a large big time criminal trial that got a lot of eyeballs, I think a lot of lawyers would line up for that, wouldn't they?
Potentially they might say, gee, this should work that way. But, you know, you ask a client, how did you come to, you know, to contact me? How did you choose me? And it's really rare that somebody says, gee, I heard you on the radio and I like the way you handle things. It has been frequently, it's word of mouth. It can be from a variety of the lawyers. You're right in the way of advertising, whether billboards or these days online, can allow for an element of name recognition, an element of familiarity. There are a variety of ways to be able to market without trials being publicized where you have that opportunity. I mean, hey, there may well be lawyers who, if they're on TV or radio, the public might see the individual and say, gee, I'm not impressed. That's almost it's a deterrent. That's somebody who I'm not that impressed with. But I don't believe that there's quite as clear a cause and effect of you're on TV, you have a trial, and it does or doesn't make a lot of difference. In any event, that's sort of a side issue, because at the core of it, it's, are we at the stage in 2024 where our courtrooms in Canada can withstand that scrutiny of the media? I thought we were years and years ago. You can certainly have a case occasionally where things get such public attention, like the OJ case, that it really starts to become a circus. But the question, of course, is how much is a circus, what's happening within the courtroom versus the public reaction outside? Without saying the name of the judge to impact the quiz, I think Jay Leno used to have almost a comic-type characterization relationship.
He did.
Judge.
Yep, he did. And you know, I don't know that it would be the, and we got to go in just a minute here, I don't know that it would be the scrutiny of the media per se that would be the biggest concern with the extra attention. I think it would be social media because I, you know, some people listening are going to say, well, you're being biased and you're not being fair here. I like to believe that the media would do their absolute best to do it properly. I don't always have the same level of faith in social media with someone popping in and popping out and seeing 5 minutes on TV and saying, oh, well, look, they screwed that up. I think that becomes a big problem, if there is a problem here.
Well, in the social media world, remember, the public would have a chance to see that, too. I think one of the big issues has to do with matters of privacy, an interest that an individual may have in saying, look, I don't want my particular case or cause or experience out on the public airwaves. And so you'd have to respect the interests of some measure of for witnesses, for example. You know, we characterize it as a privacy that is retained by it being within the courtroom setting as opposed to the media. Because, Scott, to stay with your point, the issue of what might happen with images and with content being affected in some way in the social media world, yeah, there's a risk that way.
One more thing. This would, I would think, inevitably lead to more discussion in the public square. If it was a big time trial, look, whether it was O.J. Simpson or whether it was that guy in the States, I can't remember his name, who killed his wife and two kids and put them in oil vats, and it became a huge celebrity, you know, story or whatever. It would inevitably lead to more discussion. People would sit around in coffee shops or at work and talk about these things. Is that a good thing that the justice system is talked about more? Whether people are accurate about it or not, is any discussion necessarily good discussion then?
I would say so, because that's part of that's so important to our society. And the criminal justice system does have a lot of public attention. The public should have confidence in the way that it works. The public should have knowledge about it. Does it get a disproportionate share of attention? It may well, and Scott, we can't control that part of it. But I mean, by way of an example only, if we were talking, if I was on with you and we were able to take an excerpt of a cross-examination or a jury address, and you say, well, kind of play this part, let's talk about that. Now it's not me interpreting or you interpreting, your audience would get to actually hear it, and we'd be able to break it down the way it was presented in court instead of it being summarized. I believe that the society benefits, or I believe our democracy benefits. I believe the public would feel better about saying, okay, at least I heard it. I know what it sounded like. I know what it looked like.
That is Jeff Manishin. He's a criminal lawyer. He has been a Crown attorney. Interesting discussion. We're not getting it here anytime soon, but today with the death of O.J. Simpson seemed like an interesting time to look at the idea of cameras in our courtrooms. Jeff, really appreciate you doing this. Thank you.
Certainly, Scott. As always, it's a fascinating opportunity to discuss issues with you.
Appreciate that. Let us take a very quick break here on the Scott Radley Show. When we come back, we will give you your, I hate to say it, but your OJ-related quiz question today. If you followed the trial back in the day, and who didn't, you probably will be able to get the answer to today's quiz question. If you followed the trial and you can't get it, this is going to be one of those things where you smack your forehead afterwards and go, oh, how could I possibly forget? We'll give you the quiz question right after this. Stay with us.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Scott Radley Show here on 900 CHML. 5 years the Canadian Premier League has been a thing for. And four of those years, at the end of it, the same team, Hamilton's Forge FC, have been the team that was standing at the end, that won the championship. 4 years out of five. It's a pretty remarkable run of success. Well, that they are hoping to continue, because Saturday at 4 at Tim Hortons Field, Forge FC will kick off their CPL season against Cavalry FC. I have to catch myself every single time because I almost say Calvary FC, which is a whole different thing. But the Forge FC is getting their season started Saturday, as I say, at 4. And one of the guys who has been a key player on this team for a long time now, Tristan Borges, joins us now. Tristan, how are you?
I'm good. It's nice to hear that introduction from you, talking about the team and myself. Nice to hear.
Well, I'll ask you a question as we get going here. Do you know the one thing in all those 5 years that Forge FC has never been able to do? One game that Forge FC has never been able to win?
Believe me. Even though we try not to think about it, we do know. For us to win, our home opener. It's for some reason it's been very tough, so hopefully we do it this year.
Just your opener in general. I think you've got three draws and two losses in that opener, which is just bizarre because you win so much. For some reason, that first game is just a problem.
Yeah, it takes us a little bit to kind of get into the swing of things.
Is there so that is something though that guys are aware of in the dressing room?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, we try not to think about it too much. But you know, going into each year, just seeing how the year ends, it's for sure something that we at least look back in the beginning of the year what we need to do at least for next year to get better at it.
Explain for me, if you can, leaving aside the first game of the year, this is a team that there's no other team around. I don't know that there's another team in Canada, maybe it's a minor league level somewhere, but I can't think of another team that's had the kind of success, four championships in 5 years that you guys have had. What's the secret?
Yeah, to be honest with you, that's a tough question to answer, but that's a great question. Obviously, just starting up a new league, it's obviously great to just be a part of it. But, you know, having the coaching staff that we have and having the players that we've had in all of these years, we've built kind of a culture that it's all about winning. It doesn't matter how we do it. It doesn't matter what we'll say is the game plan on a game-to-game basis. But at the end of the day, the number one goal, and it always will be, is about winning. And, you know, being able to have at least the crowd that we've had since that first year. It's a new league. It's a new startup, but I think the progress it's already shown year by year has been amazing, and something 10 years down the line, that this is going to be remarkable to just think that we've been a part of it, because the league keeps growing and so does soccer in Canada. So
that has to, though, create some expectations. When you win all the time, are people not just assuming that you're going to win the next time? And if you don't win, then you've really let everybody down. I mean, it's a huge weight of expectation you've created.
No, of course. Of course. I think the number one thing is we kind of put that expectation on ourselves. Like I said, just building that culture, which we have. But, you know, one thing we've realized is I think from the outside view of it, it's a lot of success. But we've gone through a lot of ups and downs throughout each season, one way or another. And one, I think the biggest thing, at least our team has proven, is that we've been able to, you know, just conquer every single thing that we have to go through. You know, all these ups and downs is for us as a team, you know, within the squad, we get to see. It's a lot of things, and you know, everybody's going to kind of have their opinion and their own things to say, whether, you know, are we going to do it again this year or things like that. But for us, it's just, you know, starting the season off, trying to start off good in front of our home crowd, and it's the same goal at the end of the season.
It may be a weird thing to even ask you about, and it's probably the last thing you want to talk about, but the one time you didn't win, when you lost in the final, what was the response after that? Like, was it a noticeable thing in the dressing room that this is not acceptable and we're going to be back the next year? Yeah. Because you were.
Yeah, yeah. I think for me personally, I know my off season, you know, kind of went down a little bit knowing that, and couldn't really leave my mind. And I think it kind of just sparked a fire within the whole group and any new players that even came in, knowing that, you know, the season didn't end the way we wanted it to. But I think, you know, just like you even said, having 5 years already in this league and we've won four, but I think just if you really do look at it, being able to make five finals is already remarkable. Obviously, it's tough to win one, but, you know, at the end of the day, every team is kind of gunning for us, and we know that, and it's just trying to take it game by game.
So with that level of success, how do you, I know players and coaches love to use the phrase, we take every game one at a time, or every game is on, whatever. But how do you do that then when you're probably this team and has the right with what it's done to look big picture? How do you take every game one at a time and not look past some of the weaker teams in this league?
It's tough. It's tough, honestly. I think we even, you know, it's easy to say it. And like I said, It probably people won't even believe me when I say this, because we look at all the success we've already had. But even us as a team, we've gone through kind of, we'll say, struggles that it's even tough for us to kind of live up to that expectation of what we just spoke about, kind of going game by game. And sometimes we even get caught up of just thinking, okay, you know, we're the previous champions, and okay, we'll just get to the final. Sometimes you can get caught up in thinking that, but you know, one thing we've done really well every single year is finding that moment to catch ourselves in that time period where, okay, we need to switch out of this because whether we're not in a good, you know, playing stroud or we haven't got points in a couple games. And I think we've just done a great job of kind of finding that, you know, specific moment where it's either going to go downhill from here or we just turn it around and, you know, we perform every single game. But I think it starts already, obviously, with the coach, and a big part of our team is our captain, and the way he's been able to lead our team is a big vocal point for our team.
So around the rest of the league, are you guys now the evil empire?
Oh, yeah, of course. And we
they all hate you?
Too. Yeah, we love it, too, to be honest. It's how it is. And whenever we have important games in front of our home crowd, we know we have that advantage as well. So we're just looking forward to having that home opener already, and we're back at it.
I know you don't want to lose ever. Is it good for the league to have one team win all the time? It's a weird question to ask you, I know, because you want to win, of course. But yeah. Like, would it be good for the CPL if someday you shared and let someone else win?
as long as I'm playing for Forge, I want to win it every single year. Because there will be a day where, you know, me and even some of the other guys that have been with Forge all of these years, we're not going to be able to be playing anymore, right? And like I said, this league just started. And this league, as you can see, with the progress it's already been having, it's going to be around for a long time, and it's just going to keep getting more popular, and it's going to keep getting better. So there is going to be, at one point in time, there's going to be obviously other teams winning. So for me, it's just trying to bring as much championships we can to Hamilton and making sure everybody enjoys it along the way as well.
We got a couple minutes left here. Answer one thing for me, which it maybe is the biggest question as I was looking at this today. And 5 years in the league, 4 championships, 1 runner-up. How has your head coach, who you just talked about culture and building culture, how is the guy who's been responsible for that never won Coach of the Year?
It's a question. One thing I know is everybody around the league has. It's a big mystery. Honestly, it's very tough to say. And if you want my honest opinion, I personally think that winning actually kind of makes it harder, because now that we've kind of created this idea of Forge is always the best, or Forge are, you know, previous champions, this and that. I find that every single year, there's always one team that the previous year didn't do very well. And then the next year, somehow, you know, they obviously have a great year and they plan, I guess the league looks at it that it's a great coaching year from that team. And they look at it as that kind of deserves to be the coach of the year. So it's kind of weird in a way that, I guess, because it's a new league and it's in a short period of time, I think they're just kind of looking at any team that gets success now, they look at it as you know, that's going to be the coach of the year. So hopefully it does change. Hopefully he does get one.
It is one of the biggest mysteries in this league, that and we've seen it in other leagues as well, but it's a big mystery that the guy who's built this whole thing has been. I mean, you've won individual awards, and other guys on the team have won individual awards. That guy hasn't. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah,
now, the one thing that you probably, though, could have taken issue with him today, you guys were out on Tim Hortons Field on the turf. It was pouring rain. It was like a monsoon. It was cold. It was like, surely you could have said to him, can we not go to the dome today and practice under the bubble or something? Like that just seemed unnecessarily harsh.
I'm going to be 100% honest with you. And like I said, maybe some people won't believe me, but I enjoy playing in the rain. It's something where I actually do think that a lot of soccer players around the whole world will say that anytime we'll say that the pitch is wet or the ball is skipping a little bit more, it's very enjoyable to be a part of. It's fun. You know, you have some fun. Snow is a whole different story, even with the wind, but in my honest opinion, I really enjoy playing in the rain, and I know the guys do too. It was a lot of fun out there today.
Well, and I guess he bought some favor when he took you guys for training camp down to Mexico. So he gets a little bit of benefit
exactly.
of the doubt after doing that in the middle of winter.
We got the best of both worlds. So
that is Tristan Borges. You can see him and Forge FC Saturday at 4 o'clock against Calgary Cavalry. I don't know if you have trouble with that. I always get it backwards. Cavalry FC at Tim Hortons Field. I really appreciate you doing this, Tristan. Thanks.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
I will eventually get that right on the first try. but somehow it still sounds to me very much like the Easter story every time I mention that team's name. We talk about Calvary. Just is. All right, here's your quiz question. Last chance today on the quiz question. And by the way, before I get to the quiz question, they are home, if you're interested, Saturday at 4, and then April 27th, they are back home again, and May 7th. So three of the first four will be at home if you're interested in catching up with any of Forge FC action. All right, quiz question tonight. What was the name of the judge in the O.J. Simpson trial, the criminal trial? 905-645-3221, *9900, or text us at 905-645-3221. Waiting to hear from you. Back with the answer after this.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
All right, your quiz question today. What was the name of the judge in the O.J. Simpson trial? You remember some of the participants. There was Marcia Clark and there was Chris Darden. They were the prosecutors, and there was now, of course, I'm drawing a complete blank on all the names. You know, the defense lawyers. Anyway, the one I could not remember today earlier when I heard that O.J. Simpson had died, Johnny Cochran was one of them. Barry Scheck. Remember Barry Scheck, the DNA guy? All these people became household names. Anyway, the one I could not remember earlier today was what was the name of the judge. And I had to look it up. So I thought, well, if I can't remember, maybe some others can't, but apparently most of you can. Jeff Manishin, who was just on with us earlier talking about TV in the courtroom, mentioned as a hint that Jay Leno used to have, remember Jay Leno had the dancing Itos? Lance Ito was the name of the judge. We had a bunch of close ones. We had Cito, we had Shapiro, but we also had a bunch of Itos. Matt, who were they?
Okay, we've got Frank, Paul, Jason, Carl, Peggy, Walter, Hugh, Roy, Neil, Marianne, James, Mondoon, Bud, and Dan.
Way to go. See, I knew some people would know this way better than me. They would remember better than I did, but... as usual, I am correct when I rely upon the brilliance of the audience. If I just assume the audience is going to be smarter than me, I'm usually right. So there you go. Well done, everybody. Tomorrow, we are back at 6 o'clock to wrap the week. Brightest conversation in Hamilton Radio tomorrow at 6. Would love it if you would join us then. Till that time, have yourself a great night. See ya.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.